Ladies and gentlemen, may I say, first of all, what a pleasure it is to look around and see so many old friends whom I haven't seen for a long, long time. And this hall brings back an extraordinary memory, because as a very young schoolmaster, the very first time I conducted any school music with Farnham Grammar School Choir was actually in this hall, because in those days Farnham Grammar School itself hadn't got a school hall. And I remember up here causing a scandal because we sang something by George Dyson, and for the next thing I upset everybody by doing "Oh What a Beautiful Morning" from Oklahoma. But that was a long time ago. I must say thank you to George for that kindly introduction. And may I use this opportunity, before Geoffrey and I really get going, to say, pay tribute to George Baxter. Because at Farnham Grammar School, there's no doubt about it, we had a remarkable music department. We did some extraordinary things over the years together. We became nationally known. We also did some very amusing things. We had a lot of fun. We gave a lot of pleasure. And certainly George had to put up with a rather eccentric school music master. I will remember on one occasion, this is the nature of George Baxter and the backing he gave us all. On one occasion, Lenny Bernstein was arriving in London with the New York Philharmonic. It was one of his very first visits. This is an awful long time ago. And he was going to do a concert for young people in the Royal Albert Hall on a Wednesday afternoon in February. Now, Bernstein's children's concerts in New York were very famous. And I was determined somehow or other that Farnham Grammar School was going to be at that concert that Wednesday afternoon. Remember, this is the middle of the week. So I went to see the headmaster. I did a pretty good sales job on Bernstein and the New York Philharmonic and children's concerts. And he suddenly realized that, it, my golly, that afternoon, school exams, school mocks. George took one look at me and said, right, we'll cancel the exam. So there we are. But we're here to talk music, and Geoffrey and I have got together and thought out, more or less, we're going to ramble a little bit, but I've got the script here to keep us more or less going if we can. Geoffrey, I lost touch with you when you left school, and then I got to know you a little bit, and we occasionally bumped into each other when you were a repetiteur at Covent Garden. Then you disappeared abroad, I went about my business, you went about yours, and then I heard rumors coming from Sweden, where I believe it was in Sweden you first took up the baton. Was that the case?
It was in Gothenburg. It was really a very reluctant thing that I did. I had left Covent Garden to go to Germany and work in the Cologne Opera House as assistant to John Pritchard, because I felt I ought to improve my German. German opera being very much what I was interested in at the time, still am very much. And it was while I was there that two opera singers, Donald McIntyre, the New Zealand baritone, and Ragnar Ulfung, who was is still a very distinguished Norwegian tenor, now character tenor, were discussing things in general with me. Ragnar was about to take over the Gothenburg Opera, and he was looking for a conductor for a second run of Carmen's. And he asked me my advice, and while I was scratching my head, it was Donald who said, well, why don't you do it? And I said, over my dead body. And that was all I thought was going to happen, except the next morning, Ragnar, behind my back, went to the Cologne Artistic Bureau of the Opera House and actually got me leave, without my knowing it, to go and do it. So I found myself with a fait accompli and found myself conducting Gothenburg's Carmen without ever having conducted an opera in my life before. That was what was so extraordinary. It really was being thrown in totally at the deep end. And I accepted only on the condition that I could get out after the first orchestra rehearsal. I thought, if this is going to be terrible, I will never do it again. It seemed to work. I thought I was awful. They thought I was all right at the rehearsals. And the extraordinary thing was then, it's no longer true now, on the first night, when I ought to have been as nervous as hell, I actually walked into that pit as though it was the most natural thing in the world that I could possibly do. I felt suddenly that I was actually doing something that I ought always to have been doing. And I think probably that was the moment that I realized that even though I wasn't going to be any good, I was going to have to do this. There was a feeling as the music moved under my hands that this was what I'd been waiting to do all my life, even though you put me off it at times, I know. Can I just butt in there? I've got a theory about conductors. We've not prepared this at all. Conductors, like teachers, you can learn technique of teaching, you can learn the technique of conducting. That doesn't make you a conductor or it doesn't make you a teacher. Conductors are born and not made.
This was brought home to me by Rudolf Kemper, the very distinguished German conductor, whom I had the enormous honor of working for at Covent Garden. One of the great things that happened to me was that during my time at Covent Garden, I worked for conductors now dead who carried with them the tradition, the German tradition, of, shall we say, learning to conduct by being in an opera house. I mean, there's no other putting it, including Schmidt Ischestedt, Joseph Cripps, and Rudolf Kemper, who was perhaps the greatest of the three. And I was playing rehearsals for a lecture for Kemper, and there was a stage and orchestra rehearsal at the end of which he needed to hear the offstage cries of Egist, or Rest, whatever it is, from the offstage chorus, and you can't tell from the pit. I mean, one of the terrible things that you discover as an opera conductor is when you stand in the pit, you don't actually hear a lot of things. You have to take it on faith that people are doing what you want them to do. And he, in order to check this and verify this, suddenly, leaning across many a more distinguished colleague, thrust his baton in my hand. And I, a little humble repetiteur, found myself being thrust into the pit, conducting this extremely difficult opera, Prima Vista, at sight. And I rather enjoyed it, of course. And the orchestra applauded like this, which they'd only do if you were a newcomer and were never going to do it again. And afterwards, I dared to go up to Kemper and say, "What do you think it's worth going on?" I mean, it's a rather silly question. And I said, "Could I have lessons?" He said, "Well, there was one person I know," and I became interested. And he said, "Yes, he lived in East Germany, is now dead. And otherwise than that, I think all you have to do is really do it and go on doing it until it becomes natural. If you can do it, you will be able to do it. Don't ever fall into the trap of becoming a pupil or a follower of someone. You must do it yourself." And I think that's absolutely true. If it is in your blood or your hands, then it is in your hands.
Yes, yes. It's been said, I know, by one or two people, and it was actually said by a lady conductor recently, that conducting can be an ego trip. Is that true or false?
I've never found it an ego trip, I must say. It's too difficult. It's too... When you think that you have to, in an opera, for instance, coordinate an 90 people in the pit...
You've got your hands full.
150 to 200 people on the stage sometimes in a large opera, to be thinking the whole time of what each individual person in the orchestra and on stage will need from you. Yes. I don't see that it can be an ego trip. It's only an ego trip afterwards. When that is that could be a danger. But I sometimes even fall into myself of being very delighted with myself for the first 10 minutes after I finish doing it. Simply, I think the relief that you've stopped doing it.
Yes, it's an extraordinary thing. I asked the same question once to another conductor, Leonard Bernstein. And he told me, I mean, Bernstein, apparently when you see him on the box, is, or in the flesh, seems to be a showman, I mean, in all sorts of respects. And I once asked him about this, and he told me, and I have no reason to believe otherwise, because I did get to know him quite well at one point, that he is never actually conscious of what he's really doing, except in terms of the music. In other words, I mean, if he looks like Uriah from the back, he's totally unaware.
I think it's absolutely true. You can calculate occasionally, but if you start to calculate, you stop conducting the music.
Yes, quite so. You know, over dinner recently, we were talking, and I remember I said to you, I think the day of the prima donna conductor is over. I mean, we've had the great conductors, the Beechams, the Toscaninis, and so on. Maybe Carian and the Bernstein are the last. Is the day of the megastar prima donna conductor over?
One has to, I think, go back to thinking why they came into being. I mean, the conductor as an animal is a fairly late phenomenon in music. I mean, it doesn't really start existing until the middle of the 19th century. And it began to be important as an orchestra grew. I mean, an 18th century orchestra could be conducted by one man playing with a fiddle, or before stomping a stick. Whereas by the time you get to Berlioz and Wagner with an orchestra of 90 people, you need to begin to have one person controlling who's not playing. That's true. And of course the conductor became more and more important in order to entangle the sort of complexities that the 19th century actually brought. So it's only by the end of the 19th century you get people like Richter, Mahler, himself a composer of course as well, who I think were the first megastars as such. And it was a relatively short reign, if you think about it, because I'm talking about a period now of only about 100 years in which the conductor has been preeminent, because he's had to be. The music has made him preeminent. The other thing was, I think, is that we moved naturally into a more democratic age in terms of what musicians themselves think. The young musician now being trained in college is trained to think for himself, to have his own musical ideas. And even if he finds himself in an orchestra of 90 people, that feeling will come out, and I think you as a conductor begin to have to respect it. There is another, there's one other rather sad feature which has actually led to, I think, to the demise of the megastar in terms of your Beecham, your Fortefeng, I mean the people to whom, frankly, no orchestral musician would ever raise their voice, is that unionism, and I'm not being political in any sense, but the fact that musicians are now protected by their unions, they have a feeling, a natural feeling, that they can defend their own rights against the tyranny of some, many conductors of that generation were very unpleasant people to deal with. If you listen to orchestral musicians of a certain age talk about the attitudes of Toscanini or Furtwängler, I mean, they were treated, frankly, like shit. to put too blunt a term on it. In fact, until very recently, I mean, one of the great conductors of the last generation, the last great German generation, Karl Böhm, was an extremely difficult and unpleasant man to deal with. But he obtained wonderful results musically. But he only obtained them because he was 90. I don't think you will find that any young orchestra would put up with Karl Böhm today. I certainly couldn't do the same. They'd walk out on me.
Yes, I've heard other conductors say if you're dictatorial to an orchestra these days, you just don't get anywhere. It's as simple as that.
I think it's more positive than that. And my feeling is that if you are dealing with 90 trained people who have something to offer themselves, you should, even if you don't let them speak to you, be aware of what they can give you back in return. Yes, and I think you make better music as a result of allowing the person in front of you to contribute in some sense.
One of the great
virtues of Klemperer in his days with the Philharmonia as a conductor was that he had an amazing group of musicians under his baton. And because in a way he was limited physically to what he could actually show them, they managed to express within his general outline their own individuality, which gave those performances a very, very special quality. You know?
One of the interesting things is, although I myself feel that the day of the megastar conductor is on the wane, is with the advent of LPs, Geoffrey, and the record industry, you go around, you see huge posters of classical musicians, including yourself, record sleeves with pictures of every musician under the sun, and it's almost as if the record industry is marketing or attempting to market classical music in the same way that it markets pop music to the youngsters. It doesn't always work for the very simple reason I know of at least two artists, obviously I mustn't name names, two artists who've received this sort of publicity by one of the big record companies, whose records do not sell, whose images have gradually faded and whose contracts have gradually just ceased, because I believe that the music public is a much more discerning one than we like to think. Or am I wrong?
Obviously one has to sell a product. I mean, the making of a gramophone record is the making of a product. I'm very concerned, I'm very aware that I will only go on making records if my records sell. And I'm aware that my gramophone company thinks exactly the same thing. The moment I stop selling gramophone records, I will stop making them. It's very simple. And therefore they choose and have to think of ways of marketing. And it's absolutely true that if you make a certain name, people think I can sell it on that. I would not agree with that method, in fact, because I think the only thing that really counts, and the public knows this, is what the results on the disc are. And after a while, you grow to love a record not because Mr. Cowan's face is on it, but because of what he's managed to do. I don't think that the public of today, being very educated musically, much more educated, I think, than they were even 50 years ago, I mean, the quantity of music that one hears leads one naturally to be able to choose quality by one's own ears and not by a face. I understand the predicament of any company having to do this. At the moment, we're lucky. We're living in a time when, because of the compact disc suddenly coming, records can be sold more easily. But I mean, as soon as the compact disc becomes a matter, a normal matter, it'll become difficult again.
Yes.
And I think, well, I hate to say it, you'll find more rather than less selling on terms of publicity and other public image. It's inevitable if you're dealing with a commercial concern.
Yes. Actually, the compact disc, the gramophone record, I mean, undoubtedly has brought music to millions of people who wouldn't otherwise have bought it. But at the same time, I think it's a very dangerous thing. Because you know, as well as I do, Geoffrey, you can record a Beethoven symphony until it's out, and you can re-record until it's note perfect, until it's absolutely there without a single flaw. And okay, you get used to hearing it in your own home on your own splendid machinery. Then you come to the Barbican and you hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and there's bound to be somewhere or other the odd slip here and there. And if you're really listening, I've heard many people say they prefer listening to sheer perfection at home rather than a live concert at the Barbican. Now this for me is totally wrong, because listening and sharing what is you are offering us with my fellow men around me, with you, is, even if there are wrong notes, is a much more important experience than sitting in isolation at home listening to a perfect compact
piece. I think you have to make an effort. I think Britain actually said this in his Aspen lecture. The danger of recorded music is that people will stop making an effort to come and listen to music. I mean, we can't talk about what music is, who knows what it is, and what it means to individual people. But the act of coming to a room, gathering together to listen to music, has a certain, call it religious.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that degree of concentration by 2,000 people is part of the experience of listening to music.
Absolutely.
And one thing the gramophone has done, sadly, in a way, has actually taken away from that act.
Yes.
Which is a way, worship is the wrong word, but it is some sort of communal act.
With that.
Now, as a conductor, you feel that to yourself. I mean, on an evening when the public is with you, that's an indescribable pleasure. And I think the public themselves have something from that they cannot have.
Yes, I think it's also this too. I can sit at home and listen to my compact disc, and I can be quite excited or moved. At the end of it, I'm not going to do that in the silence of my drawing room. Whereas if you're with a crowd of people, we all applaud together. Now, what is the nature of applause? First of all, it's not just purely thank you to the orchestra and the conductor. I don't think it's purely adulation of the conductor. I think it's an absolute emotional necessity within the audience to react, to respond, and to release.
Yes, Beecher would have said, of course, if you ended something loud enough, they would applaud loudly.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's, yes. I mean, you can't always judge the quality of your own work by the nature of the applause that comes
after. No, I couldn't ask you about that.
I mean, you know, if you really, I promise you, if you end something loudly enough and daringly enough, people will applaud, even if what's happened before is really not worth it. No, but applause is undoubtedly important. It is a gesture. I mean, why? I have never understood, and it's a question that I would pose to everybody. Why is the making of that noise indicative of appreciation? There must be some sociologist who could tell me why that is. But it's undoubtedly true that one does need to make some sort of gesture afterwards. It's a function of music. Music works in time and with tension.
Yes.
And if the music has worked upon you, the tension needs to be released. And of course, doing that actually really...
Yes.
You notice that in music, actually, just touching on Berlin, the experience in Berlin, which we didn't intend to talk about so quickly, but one of the extraordinary things of that was that there wasn't applause in East Berlin for about 30 seconds.
Quite
that means the tension was so enormous that it went beyond the ability to release it. It actually stood still, unreleased, for about 30 seconds. And it was one of the most eerie experiences, I think, of my life. Yeah. I couldn't quite believe that that was actually happening. Then suddenly it just came like a huge wave. People communally felt it. And that's what I was saying, going back to what I said about the necessity of the communal experience.
What is also interesting, too, is the nature of applause the world over. For example, the Canadians, I've been to many concerts in Canada, are extraordinary. I think if you just get up and sneeze on the stage in Canada, you have a standing ovation at once. Whereas in Japan, I remember the World Orchestra in Tokyo, we gave a marvelous performance of The Rite of Spring, of Stravinsky. At the end, the Japanese are so polite, you wonder whether they really liked it or not. We knew it was a good performance, in actual fact. They're terribly polite. What's your experience internationally of applause?
Well, the Japanese were actually very enthusiastic about Mozart. I mean, I was there last year, and I did 7 concerts, so I had an ability to judge what they responded to. And I noticed that their applause was very delicately timed, and also, in terms, also tuned to the work that you'd actually done. Not so much whether they thought you were good or not, but the actual the nature of the piece they related their applause to. If it ended rather solemnly, they just did this. If they ended a little bit more extravagantly, they gave a little bit more. It was never what I would call overwhelming. It couldn't.
No, exactly.
It could,
no.
But always considered, Alan.
Yes.
Whereas, in fact, I mean, applause, for instance, in France, of all unlikely places, in a way, because the French are a curious nation. I'm never quite sure how musical they really are. But they are very enthusiastic. When they're enthusiastic, they are wildly enthusiastic, will scream, shout, bravo, bis, for no apparent reason.
Yes.
The English are warm, I must say, very warm. The Americans, a little less so, curiously. The Dutch will always stand up for you, always. There are national differences.
Yes, there are.
It is very extraordinary. Yes. Why the Dutch stand up, I don't know, but they do.
Yes.
And I've tried to...
Does it annoy you when you get a huge ovation? I've been at one of your concerts at which you had a pretty good reception, Geoffrey, and I thought deservedly so, but you know as well as I do, even Beecham gave bad performances. Everybody says, oh, I remember the days of Beecham. Beecham gave bad performances, and I've certainly heard Bernstein give some indifferent performances as well as some marvellous ones. Every conductor is bound to give indifferent performances. When you get a tremendous applause for an indifferent performance, does that annoy you?
Yes.
It should do.
Yes,
yeah.
How should I say? It's this function, again, of what Beecham said about finishing loudly. I mean, you know, there is a manipulative element in what you do. And if you've manipulated people correctly, you can conceal certain things, but you don't feel very good for having done so. I often feel much happier when a performance has been brilliantly good or of a piece that's difficult to understand. It's not been well received by the public in terms of amount of applause, but I know that I have done what I can. I mean, that is...
Richard Rodney Bennett once said something very interesting to me about applause. He said he hates polite applause or indifferent applause. If he writes a work and the audience go bananas about it at the end, he's very happy. If they boo him, he's just as happy because at least he's got some reaction from them. But if it's just that, he gets annoyed.
Well, booing is lovely. It's great fun. I mean,
have you ever been booed?
Yes, it's great
Tell
fun.
Tell me where.
I was booed along with the producer in Munich for the Salome we did last year because the production was actually rather bad. And of course I was associated with that, and therefore I got booed. I rather enjoyed that because I thought it was actually entirely appropriate to what I'd been involved in. I mean, I had no qualms, and I remember vividly the booing in Bayreuth for the Schero Ring, which was actually unforgettable. Ferocious and therefore wonderful fun. I mean, we stood behind the curtain encouraging, hoping that there was going to be more, simply because we knew that we'd done something that was worth doing, and we knew that we had annoyed people. And in a curious way, one must never forget, I mean, music is not just to be worshipped, it also is to provoke, particularly opera.
Yes, absolutely.
And we provoked, and how we provoked, and therefore we had a response. I don't think there's anything wrong in that. I think it's rather good. I agree with you. In the sort of polite...
The polite applause is monstrous.
Is actually monstrous.
Yes. Yes,
I mean, then I'm now given the bad performance. I mean, then I really do know.
Yes.
If it's really
Yes. But this leads us really naturally enough into musical criticism and the critics. Now then, when a critic gives you a good notice for an indifferent performance, what's your reaction? What is the function of the critic? I've never known now what the function of the music critic is. He's not a guru, yet so many people read him and rely on his words. I know a number of critics, since I've worked for you, for music quite well. Some of them really know very, very little indeed. And I'll give you a lovely story here. Last night I heard, I was at Jeffrey's concert, and a young violinist who was indeed helped an enormous amount by Youth and Music, called Nigel Kennedy, now making a huge name for himself, gave a tremendous performance of the Elgar Concerto with Jeffrey conducting. About 8 years ago, I was going to go to a concert in London at which a much younger and much less starry Nigel Kennedy was playing, and the music critic of a very well-known quality newspaper was in the pub beforehand. And he came up to me and I said, I'm looking forward enormously to tonight to hearing Nigel play the Walton Concerto. And he was so snooty about Nigel Kennedy, for whom I've always fought and supported. And he said, oh, I heard him do the Elgar at the Proms, it's awful. And I challenged him, I said, why was it awful? Well, he fumbled around for a while. And I said, well, now, don't worry, my friend, but Walton's absolutely right for him. This romantic work. And I threw in a few spoofed technical terms. Kennedy did do it pretty well. Next morning, I opened the newspaper. I can tell you what the newspaper is because the critic is no longer writing for it. He's writing for the opposition now. It was The Guardian. I opened it. Nigel Kennedy was given a rave notice, complete with my completely made-up spoof terms.
They're a necessary evil, as you see. They do fulfill a function, sadly, in a way, sometimes, because I think the fact that every day you can read about a musical event is important. I mean, it's important for us in the business to know that it actually is being taken that seriously. I mean, even if it's not what you would agree with to read, at least it means that our business is being talked about and is a natural function of London and provincial life. I mean, I find that important. I mean, that's what criticism has always done. It's brought it out into the open. As to learning from what they write, I don't think you ever can. I mean, if they praise you for indifference, which they often do, you must ignore it. If they criticize you what was good, you must somehow bear with that. I mean, that's painful, but you must bear with it. I think in the end effect, a professional musician doesn't read them.
No, Ben never read them.
I think it's probably wise, because if you're praised, you're praised for the wrong things, usually. And I think if you're criticized, you're criticized for the wrong things. But I think, nonetheless, I like to know they're being written, because people read them, people get angry with them, people agree with them. It stirs up enough to make us always, you know, always in the news as such. They also do launch careers, Alan.
They can do the reverse.
I think quality will out, I think always.
Yes.
Someone of quality will come through, and certainly in England, in general, I'm not thinking about other lands. I mean, America's much more difficult. I mean, the New York Times, for instance, that is an occasion of bad criticism, because here is a town in which there's just one newspaper of any distinction. It has a group of people, most of whom do not know anything about music, most of whom can't write English, which really annoys me, and these people can ruin a career. These people can actually totally damn a young artist, and there, I must say, I think criticism is naturally dangerous. Whereas in London we have 8 papers, or more, 9 papers. On each of them there's one person, usually, who has something to say, Alan. And they will disagree among themselves, and from that a consensus of opinion can be formed, you know?
Yes, except that most people don't read 9 newspapers, they only read one.
That is absolutely true. We won't... I think one should read more than one newspaper.
Yes.
I mean, but that's...
We won't ask which one, Geoffrey. But it's also true to say that the more vitriolic a critic is, the greater the more famous his name becomes.
Oh,
and
yes.
They know this technique very, very well indeed.
This was one of great... In New York, there was a very famous critic who worked, in fact, in New York Magazine, and was so vitriolic that nothing was acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And a very mild critic who was on the New York Times took over his position on the same magazine and suddenly became vitriolic overnight. And so it was very clear that the newspaper had said, you will be vitriolic. This is what you should be.
Mm-hmm.
That is rather frightening when someone has that amount of power. But they don't really.
No.
I don't think you can say they do. And when they're very good, there are a few people who I read with great pleasure because I learn something from them.
Yes.
I learn something from David Cairns, for instance, always.
Stephen Pettit.
Stephen Pettit. I used to learn a great deal from Peter Hayworth, who is a very these people actually have the right, I think, to comment.
Yes.
I mean, when I have someone who has heard all these people, and they make a comparison and they make a criticism, which I often can be valid, then it's worth listening to.
Yes. There's certainly one critic writing in one of the well-known papers today, practically every day, who writes the most beautiful English. His knowledge of music, his actual knowledge of music, is minimal. But he writes the most beautiful English. It makes marvellous reading.
Yes, I'm almost prepared to forgive him for that, I must say. I mean, in a way, they should be artists themselves. I mean, if they're going to be good critics, they should be artists themselves.
Yes, but I think there's more to it than that.
Yes?
No. This is the moment in which we were going to talk about the present state of musical education, but I see that time is pressing on. Let's go on instead. Let's skip that bit. We'll do that bit at the end if necessary. let's talk about contemporary music. Now, it seems to me, Geoffrey, and I've said this to you before, that now that Shostakovich is no longer with us, now that Benjamin Britten is dead, there is no contemporary composer colossus of the world. You could switch on the radio, you could hear two bars of Shostakovich, and it was Shostakovich. There was no doubt about it, it was there. You could hear two bars of Benjamin Britten, and it was Benjamin Britten. And it's very interesting to me, in my capacity, dealing with young people the world over with music, that whenever I get off an aeroplane and I go and they discover that I'm come from England, the one name they produce every time, everywhere, is Benjamin Britten. They don't mention Walton or Vaughan Williams, but it's Benjamin Britten. And there's no doubt about it, Britten was a colossus, Shostakovich. But where is it? Who is it now? I don't think there is one at the moment.
I certainly haven't come across one, I must say. Henze, I have performed and enjoyed performing Henze, but the voice is much less important for me than either of the other two. You and I talked about Michael Tippett, who has become, because of seniority now, I think, the sort of the grandfather of English music making. But I must say, I find his latest work more difficult to understand.
Yes.
Lutoslawski, maybe?
Well, yes.
Henderecki, yes.
Messiaen?
Ligeti, yes. Messiaen.
He's got a distinctive voice.
That's a distinctive voice.
Though he does
voice.
Go on a bit, doesn't he?
Well, that opera that lasts 7 hours, I must say, I don't think I want to conduct. But,
well, there was a new organ work broadcast yesterday afternoon, a new organ piece. It started at 2:30 and it finished at 4:45, which is an awful long time to be playing the organ.
I must say, yes. Well, I mean, but, Is this because we actually don't know any more the function of concert pieces, what they're meant to do? I mean, the whole nature of for whom you write this music has slightly changed. Ben and Shostakovich were the last people I knew who wrote for you, so to speak. I mean, for an audience of normal people who came to listen to music without necessarily having an erudite knowledge of the latest trends or fashions. I mean, Ben wanted to communicate. Mm. You may find some of his music still rather difficult, but nonetheless, I think the more you listen, the more you appreciate. I mean, and the pieces now make a lot of sense to more people than they ever used to.
Do you remember his statement? I think it was in the Aspen lecture again. I want this music to be used and to be used now.
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes.
You could play it now, it made sense now. I mean, I remember listening to first performances and they made sense.
Yes.
I now listen to first performances of pieces and have to struggle myself, and I'm a professional musician. Now, I think I ought to struggle, and I'm trying, because undoubtedly out of this period something will happen.
Yes.
I mean, you always professed the philosophy that you thought that the emphasis had shifted towards what we used to call the lighter element of music, that has been the communicative music had become the musical, you know.
Yes, I think that's changing, though.
And that is also changing, because it seems to me that has also vanished to a certain degree.
Yes.
We are in a time of great crisis. I did there is wonderful esoteric music being written for a wonderfully esoteric public. Mm. That is about 300 people per concert. I mean, and the music is no less valid in that sense. It's very good music. But I feel very sad that 2,000 people don't rush and flock to hear that.
No, it was rather interesting. It seems to me the world over there are many, many competent, technically brilliant composers, all rather grey, all sounding rather the same. Now, last night I heard you do
Ring by the Bright Horizon.
By George Benjamin, who's a young man aged 28, 29, and technically brilliant. There's no doubt about it. And I sat there and I thought to myself, I'm not criticizing the work, but I thought this could be written by almost anybody anywhere. Am I right?
Well,
could you have said, Geoffrey, quite in all honesty, this is by an Englishman? I don't think you could. No,
I wouldn't. I mean, don't forget, that is a phenomenon that's come rather late into music, the concept of music comes from a particular country. I mean, in the 18th century, you could perhaps have said that an opera came from a certain country, but it was unlikely. I mean, you know, Handel wrote Italian operas as good as any Italian. The idea of nationalism is fairly late, and I don't know, wouldn't know even whether then you could call English as such. I mean, Britain wrote in a very international language, as did Shostakovich. I mean, their greatest elements are not necessarily their English. Their Russian, in that sense.
Yeah.
The thing about Benjamin, the piece by Benjamin, which is a very interesting piece, is that it's his first piece. He was a boy of 18 or 19.
Yeah.
Now, that's very remarkable, I think, for a boy of that age. And I think something will happen. But he has no language to speak.
Mm.
He has to find his own language. It's what I think you and I miss. We miss a language, a musical language. People are looking for it. There is a sort of a strange degree of uncertainty about what music should now say.
Yes. Is the answer going to come, do you think, from the new breed of composer on the west coast of America, the minimalists? Now, I listened to one or two minimalist composers, and this opera, Akhenaten, had this enormous success at the Coliseum last year. It drove me absolutely potty after 20 minutes, I must say. But quite by accident, last November, December, I switched on my radio at home as I was doing something or other, and I heard some very interesting music coming out, and it seemed it was clearly minimalist, but my golly, here was a composer who was actually writing tunes one could whistle and hum again. In fact, there seems to me to be a gradual return to melody. Some of the younger people are certainly writing melody again, and the composer concerned was John Adams. Some of you may have seen a fortnight ago there was a program on Channel 4 with Simon Rattle talking about the music of John Adams. I'm wondering if this is a direction, I don't know, or are there many directions, or what?
Well, melody, after all,
it's fundamental, I think.
I would have thought the thing which we all first of all recognize in music and come to want in music one of the most important elements of it. Certainly, I now read with interest that Mr. Adams, you talked about, whose music I don't know very much about, but I was reading about an opera that he's just written where people say because of the return to melody, the effect of the opera is very strong. I mean, people actually sing. Now, I had the pleasure of doing the first performance of a work by Rob Lieberman, who's an old composer, but who himself wanted to return to what he would say singable opera last year in Geneva, a piece based on a Russian play, The Storm by Ostrovsky, The Forest by Ostrovsky, The Storm is Katikovana. And he actually tried consciously to return to a style of bel canto, to vocal display, with enormous success. I mean, it was as though the public in Geneva, who was a perfectly normal public, had been waiting for something like this. The music didn't make any particular concessions, it wasn't easy as such, but he wrote it to be sung and to have melody.
Yes.
And it immediately struck a response. And I have a feeling that the people who are doing that are going to show us the way.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
We talked about Robin Holloway as a young Englishman who was doing the same. It's even reputed that Boulez has written a tune.
My God.
Yes, one tune. For a solo cello, but it was a tune.
There's a lovely story about Vaughan Williams, which his wife told me. Apparently, he was, just before he died, about a year or two before he died, he did a tour of American universities. By the time he got to Harvard, he was really very, very tired indeed. And after all, he was some age. And he had to sit through an afternoon of compositions by young students. And he kept nodding off. And Ursula kept nudging him. After all, he was supposed to be the great man giving advice to these students. And the final work was apparently quite excruciating. And the young student came down to meet the great Dr. Vaughan Williams and for advice, and Dr. Vaughan Williams peered at him and said, "My one piece of advice, laddie, if perchance you do think of a tune, do hasten to write it down." And, Geoffrey, let's talk a little bit more about, the whole business of opera and musicals. Are the two combining? Whither is the future of opera? Boulez said, you might as well burn down all the opera houses. It seems to me that when you get what I regard as the most important man in the field of the musical, Stephen Sondheim, without any doubt whatsoever, writing some of his latest stuff, which is getting remarkably close to opera, and the big public are buying it. On the other hand, contemporary operas, the ones I've heard lately, I find a little worrying. Where are we off to in the opera house?
Well, as I said, this one piece last year seemed to indicate the composers or could possibly return to some form of melody. I mean, we've got stuck again since Britain. It's very interesting.
Yes.
Except with the possible, there the possible exception of Henser, who does actually know how to write for the voice.
Yes.
The problem of the opera house is it is a museum. I mean, Boulez is quite right. Our repertory is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very small number of pieces, which there are now increasingly fewer singers available to do. I mean, mm-hmm. let us be perfectly honest, there are no real Wagnerian singers of any stature mm-hmm. at this particular mm-hmm. moment, and very, very few who can sing Verdi. If you take Verdi and Wagner out of our repertory, we're left with precious little. I mean, mm-hmm. we are exploring, and this is more, even more museum-like. Opera houses are now looking to the 18th century, the 17th century for help, and we are, by the help of very skillful production, turning these pieces, for instance, Nicholas Haydn's production of Xerxes, these pieces into
yep.
great entertainments. And in
yes.
fact, it may well be that we need to look at our past in that sort of light and yes. reinterpret it.
Yep.
But I must say, I would very much like there to be a Stephen Sondheim writing for the Royal
Opera House. Well, it's very interesting.
Yes. Possible.
Oh, yes. Well, Stephen Sondheim is incredible. I mean, not only musically, but the words. I mean, don't let me get going on Stephen Sondheim, and we should be here till midnight.
But you know, the problem is, Alan, you see, that yeah. most of the operas written in the last 30 years has not actually been written for voices as we know.
Exactly.
I
yes.
mean,
yeah.
Berg wrote two great operas, which mm. pushed the voices, I think, probably yeah. to the greatest limits that you would
yes.
expect a human voice
yes.
to take. I mean, they're
yes.
both, in fact, masterpieces. They're both, mm. interestingly enough, operas with extremely strong stories.
Mm.
Both Wozzeck and Lulu yeah. are marvellous stories in themselves.
Mm.
And both Britten and Henser have been clever enough always to use
extremely
good stories.
Yes.
Now, I mean, a piece by Richard Rodney Bennett, which I must say is not perhaps necessarily musically on the level of Britten.
No, no.
Carried an enormous weight. It was a piece called The Mines of Sulphur,
well,
because it had a damn good story.
Yes.
And was very
yes.
good theatre.
Yes.
I find it very difficult now to find operas which are good theatre as such.
Yes, but on the other hand, I mean, I suppose, without any doubt, some of the most popular operas ever written were those by Puccini. And if you really examine the storyline of just one or two, the narrative is not so hot. So what made Puccini tick? I mean, somebody once said Tosca works because the things that people like in the theatre are a bit of religion, a bit of violence, and a bit of sex, and Tosca's got the lot. Is that true?
Yes, but yes, it's quite yes. a good plot. I mean, you might come off it. I mean, things happen in Tosca.
Yes.
You know, I mean, in the first act, someone rushes on and rushes off, and you realize he's a convict. I mean, there comes a villain on the piece. There's
yes.
a lady in love with somebody else. I
yes.
mean, you know, there's enough machinery to keep you going. There's wonderful stuff in the second act.
Yes.
And it makes sense as a story.
Yes.
You could actually set it in Russia. You could set it in present-day Colombia or
yeah.
somewhere and get
yeah.
away with it.
Yes.
It's actually still very relevant. No, they're good
yes.
stories.
They're good stories.
They also have wonderful, wonderful melody.
Oh, yes.
That's true.
Yes.
And you need both. You
yes.
must have both.
Yes.
I resent the fact that composers don't actually write with the voice.
Yes.
I mean, it's a genuine cri de coeur.
You once told me that one of the most difficult things you'd ever conducted was Fledermaus. Now, I know little about conducting. Why is Fledermaus so difficult?
Well, operetta is horribly difficult.
It's the whole genre. It's not just Fledermaus.
Fledermaus, being the sort
yeah.
of pinnacle of operetta, I suppose, is the most difficult in a way because it's the most fine.
Yes.
It's Mozart with rubato, if you can imagine that. It has to have the finesse and transparency of Mozart
yes.
with extraordinary rubato.
Yes.
I mean, no
yes.
bar is quite the same. And
yeah.
for a singer and you to feel it exactly the same time, as well as 90 minutes
yes.
of orchestra, does demand an enormous technique.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
these are amazing pieces.
Yes, oh, yes. I
wouldn't like to say that we should do more operetta, necessarily, but I think maybe even Covent Garden might think of doing more operetta, because there is something to be said for that genre.
Well, curiously enough, there is in this country a huge public for the operetta. Sadler's Wells Operetta Company, which was formed only 4 years ago, goes up and down the country playing to packed houses, not only the Strauss operettas, but I recently saw, above all things, Noel Coward's Bittersweet, which is essentially an operetta.
Yes, absolutely.
And I went along, and I was very snooty about it indeed. I thought, really, must I go and see this thing? I ended up by absolutely loving it. And there is a public for it. And when it's well done, it is superbly done.
I think not just a nostalgic public. I mean, the piece has a certain virtue. I mean, if we can put on Trovatore, you can put on Bittersweet.
It's very interesting that the night I went, there were, through Youth for Music and our audience building techniques, there were 500 young people in Sadler's Wells Theatre. And I thought, oh my God, they're not going to like this. On the contrary, they went bananas about it. 500 youngsters, all age 18, 19.
But thinking of that, I mean, on the other hand, the Garden has just been engaged in a procedure whereby some young composers have actually tried workshop opera, actually evolving opera through improvisation. And I must say, that is probably where a lot of our future, indeed music in general, will come.
Yes.
Actually incorporating not just the professional musician, but the amateur musician, into actually trying to make it for themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in a much more corporate and democratic age than we ever did, and I think these sort of gestures will actually make us find perhaps a new genre of music ourselves, you know? The composer actually talking to the people who make the music and who listen to the music, and the thing evolving. I mean, I think why we're in a mess is probably, to a certain degree, is still because of those compartments. You know, the composer there, the audience there, the performer in the middle. And I think all these community workshop ventures are really where I would like to see some sort of development. I would expect development.
Yes. Actually, Covent Garden, your education department, I know very well, is very good, I think.
At doing that?
Excellent at doing that.
You see, because that means you create a public like these people who actually then will know what it's about. Will know. I mean, you cannot impose an alien or an esoteric language on someone who's not trained
to.
It's like, in fact, performing a French play untranslated in front of some people who only have O-level French.
Yeah.
Whereas if we constructed our play together, we would understand what we were talking about. And I feel a little worried that not enough is being done in this respect.
Yes, Geoffrey, we've got 10 minutes left. We agreed on an hour, and then we're going to open it up. We've got 10 minutes left, 5 minutes on two subjects.
Oh.
One, funding. The future of funding the arts. You, Covent Garden, we always know are short of money. Everybody in the arts is short of money. I don't wish to be political, but the present government is not sympathetic to the arts, I fear. Wither. Is sponsorship the answer? I don't think it is. One of the problems with sponsorship, first of all, in the arts, in order to survive, you've got to be planning, particularly music, 2 or 3 years hence. And so, shall we say, Smith Biscuits agree this year that they're going to give you X thousand pounds worth of sponsorship. That's marvellous, wonderful. But at the end of the year, if their profits aren't up, you're not going to get it for next year and you're already committed. Sponsorship is a very dangerous thing.
Well, it may be dangerous, but I think we have got to look for it. I mean, I worked long enough in America to be aware that it can work. I mean, there are ways of making people commit themselves over a longer period if possible, and to do that without interference. Because one of the other dangers that you didn't raise is, of course, the danger that someone who gives money will want to see what they want coming out of the end of it. And I mean, this, of course, is can be very dangerous.
Yes.
There is one lady who gives an enormous amount of money to the Metropolitan a year, but she expects to see for that certain operas and certain producers.
Yes. And what is also true is that a firm, a big organisation, will give money providing, A, they know that they're going to get a lot of exposure, public relations. They will sponsor Covent Garden doing Madame Butterfly, shall we say. But on the other hand, what is very, very important, equally as important, is the small group doing something avant-garde, something different, something that is not in the big public eye. They also need sponsorship, and that's where it becomes difficult.
It becomes almost impossible, because in fact firms only want exposure.
Absolutely.
I feel that it should be more possible for the individual members of the community to give smaller sums and get relief from it. I mean, I wish there was some way in which we could encourage a perfectly ordinary citizen who had spare £20 to give it and get some,
happens in America.
Yes, well, their system, their tax system, has until now enabled them to do that, and it would be the one thing that I would think still worth lobbying our government about is to persuade them, maybe, to make it better to give. I mean, I worked for a long time in Germany, of course, where money
flows absolutely.
And you ask yourself how it does so, but I think there we have a very musical public in England. I think they will be prepared to give just a little. It isn't a question of giving very much.
No, quite.
But there should be an incentive. We do need.
Well, what is rather interesting, I've worked on and off in Germany and also quite a lot in Scandinavia. And in Scandinavia, sponsorship is still something quite startlingly new. It's extraordinary.
Well, certainly in Germany.
Yeah, in Germany, the same thing.
I mean, the Covent Garden now, and even the English Chamber Orchestra, which is a much smaller organisation, could not exist without considerable sponsorship.
Yes.
Certainly, I mean, if the government stopped giving us money tomorrow, we would not die because we have now enough sponsorship. And it's going to get worse, of course. It's going to get a lot worse.
Yes. Well, what I can't understand, again, I don't wish, I make this quite clear, I don't wish to become political. What I don't understand, but viewed in its own monetarist terms, the musical exports of this country are well worth. I mean, I think somebody once worked out that the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra played back more in VAT than it actually received in grant from the Arts Council.
Well, English music is, in fact, a reason to be proud of being English.
Exactly.
Or British, should I say, forgive me. I mean, you know, we are still regarded, London is still regarded, as, in its way, as the musical capital of the world.
Yes.
And this makes people come to us, they buy our records, they want us. I mean, we are an asset. It would be nice to be seen as such.
Yes. It is quite true. Wherever you go in the world, and you mentioned you come from London, it is regarded as the musical capital. And it's certainly true if you look at the extent of music in London, but not now just in London. You look at nationwide, the amount of music in this country is quite extraordinary. And I think this is partly due to the rise of musical education since the war. Part of that is also the, I'm putting this rather badly, the rise of instrumental musical education. The standard of school orchestras now is higher than it's ever been. Where you get a really good school orchestra, it is superb. What worries me slightly is that there seems to have been a diminution of choral singing. All the emphasis has been on orchestral playing, but I don't think there's any doubt that the standard of our orchestras now, as a result of all this and the pyramid, and I could go on for hours on this, and we've got another 5 minutes. There's been some sort of revolution, and it's incredible. Geoffrey, two or three things to finish with. I find my musical tastes change. Composers I used to hate, I suddenly find myself liking. I don't think I want to hear Brahms for quite a while at the moment. I've heard rather a lot of Brahms lately. I'm always discovering new music. I was talking to you earlier this evening. Last night, after I got back from Geoffrey's concert, I wanted to write a letter, and by 11:45, I just switched on Radio 3, and there was a marvellous symphony coming out, Symphony No. 10 by Tubin. Who the devil is Tubin? I look him up in a book, in my dictionaries, and no sign of Tubin. Geoffrey doesn't know who Tubin is, but there's always music to discover. And I'm very, very worried sometimes that the public doesn't discover this, you know. I mean, it gets stuck on Gustav Holst's Planets or Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1, never looks at Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 2.
Well, I must say, I try to sort of slip in little things.
I'm
making a habit now of actually evolving programs in which, for the one thing that everyone knows, I will slip in one or maybe two things.
I must give you a list.
I don't actually need a list. I do. I have a list along my arm. The problem is, as you well know, you are not allowed by your sponsors and by your orchestral boards to do too much of that because, unfortunately, it is quite true, you empty halls by that. I mean, people are very conservative in what they think they can listen, what they think they can listen to. This is what depresses me a little bit.
Yes.
That's human nature. I accept human nature as such. As a conductor, conducting a piece is somehow... I can't say that I have pieces anymore that I don't really like. I mean, there's some pieces I don't respond to, as you and I well know. I'm not very fond of the early 19th century Italian opera composers, but I suspect if I had to conduct them, I'd become fascinated by them. I always am interested by what I work on. It's one of the actual joys of doing it. It feeds back to you.
Yes, and of course it's rather interesting too. I've got, like yourself, I mean, we've discussed together before our blind spots, and it's always a comment on oneself rather than on the composer. I mean, for example, Geoffrey's often taken me to task at Farnham Grammar School. He said to me not so long ago, "You never taught me anything about Wagner and Richard Strauss." Well, it's quite true, because Wagner and Richard Strauss are blind spots with me, and I do it very badly. On the other hand, Geoffrey knows only too well my enthusiasms, and so on, the English school and all the rest of it.
Yes, I've sort of inherited and suffered from them in a curious way, because I suddenly find myself programming things that I suddenly realise, my God, I heard that first with Alan in his classroom. I mean, I found myself constructing English programmes, which actually are a feedback, a throwback to 1955 in Farnham Grammar School.
But I always worked on the principle that if you really are excited about something and you can convey that enthusiasm by whatever means, and if out there you've got 30-odd youngsters around you who capture that enthusiasm and develop a taste or a love for Elgar, Britten, Vaughan Williams, and all the other people we did, Geoffrey, then they will go on and discover the rest for themselves.
Oh, absolutely true.
And I mean, that's the
I technique. Certainly went on to discover Wagner and Strauss without you, and now... and love them all the more, but I mean, never mind. However, I will say this. A piece, for instance, that you taught me to love, and perhaps unwittingly, the Britten Spring Symphony, came back to me in the back of my head about a year ago when I was trying to program something for Paris, and I actually did it in Paris to enormous success. Yes. They loved the piece, hadn't ever heard it.
Yeah, quite.
And, I mean, that is due to, a few listenings in a classroom in 1955.
Yeah.
Last week in Paris, the Parisians actually benefited from it. You see, I learned something from it.
Yes, well...
I promise you, I learned something
from it. Well, I tell you what, I promised to come to Lohengrin at Covent Garden.
Will you really come to Lohengrin?
Yes. But Britten brought us together last year, and Geoffrey was quite right. It was an extraordinary occasion in Berlin. I've been now closely associated with the World Orchestra for a long time. For me, Berlin was a terribly, terribly great occasion, and I could tell you the whole story of how it fell into place. But to have there this great British work for peace, probably the biggest musical cry for peace ever written, played by 100 youngsters from 30 countries of the world, all speaking different languages.
All playing in different sorts of ways.
And it was an extraordinary experience. And on both sides of the Berlin Wall, on the occasion of the 750th anniversary of the foundation of Berlin, the mayor of Berlin said it for him, it was the climax of all the things that happened in Berlin, and pretty well everything was happening in Berlin last year. For me, it was a deeply emotional thing because it stood for everything I've ever worked for, music, kids, and there they were. It took Michael Jenner in Berlin and myself 2 years to put this lot together. And when Berlin Festival rang me 2 years ago and they said, we want a British conductor, and I said, oh, I suppose you want, and I named another conductor, and they said, no, we want Geoffrey Tate. I nearly fell through the floor, and we had to move heaven and earth to get fixed dates for Geoffrey. But when you, as somebody who taught music in Farnham Grammar School, and Geoffrey was among one of your charges, and you now witness him conducting this incredible occasion, complete with a black boys choir from Harlem, you can imagine what it meant. It meant to me a lot. It meant to him a lot.
You were virtually in tears. It was an... I thought to myself after I did quite seriously, if I don't conduct anything again, I feel very privileged to have done that particular thing.
Yes.
Because it actually summed up a lot of things for me too.
Yes.
These were people beginning something, people who may not go on to be musicians necessarily, some of them.
Right.
The choir were amateurs, young amateurs, who, like myself, I sang in a choir like that. The soloists, with the exception of Robert Tyr, were two very young, very enthusiastic young people, also giving their all for this very special occasion. And we were all in it together. We all had the frightening experience of crossing that terrible barrier, being searched and all the rest of it. We had the extraordinarily emotional response of the East Berliners, particularly, who, for them, it was like bringing... the Holy Grail. I was bringing them something so special that I could hardly touch it. You know? I was overall, but it became more than music. I began to realize that if this is what the nature of my job is, if I can communicate what this piece means to somebody, then I will have done some good. I mean, there are many evenings when I wonder, well, why have I done that? I mean, you know, what purpose is my life actually waving my hands in front of an orchestra to make noises which people forget? Yeah. But this piece and doing it there under those circumstances seemed actually to make my own function relevant to me. And the young people gave it back to me. They played with the same sort of commitment as though they themselves, well, they did know what they were doing, why they were doing it. And music suddenly became more than just an entertainment. It became actually the centre of one's life. It became the centre of Berlin for a moment.
Yes.
And that I don't think I'll ever forget.
Well, I must say, we could go on about Berlin forever and ever and ever. We've got 10 minutes, quarter of an hour. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe you want to ask Geoffrey or myself questions. Over to you.